Courtney Karina Holden was last seen in Spokane, Washington during the summer of 2018. At the time of her disappearance, she was only 26 years old. According to the Urban Indian Health Institute, Washington State is rated second highest in the nation for missing Indigenous women cases in urban centers. In a statement from the Washington State Patrol in 2018, it stated, "Missing and murdered Indigenous women have disappeared not once, but three times, in life, in the media, and in the data." This is Courtney's story.
Hey guys, this is Ash.
This is Shiashi.
This is Maggie, and you're listening to We Are Resilient. Okay, so today I'll be telling you the story about the disappearance of Courtney Holden of Spokane, Washington. So Courtney was actually born the same year that I was born, so she would have been 29 this year. Unfortunately, Courtney's story is tragic for many reasons, but the most troubling fact is that Courtney's story didn't end in any answers. This case is still considered an unsolved cold case today. The last time Courtney Holden was seen alive was in the summer of 2018. But it wasn't until almost a year and a half later that she was actually reported missing.
How old was she when it happened?
So in 2018, she would have been 26.
Oh, wow. So she's young.
She is young.
Everybody we end up talking about are really just kind of starting to set out on their own or just they're just so young. I'm a little taken back that you said it's a year and a half before anybody reported her missing.
Yeah, and after I explain her story, it'll make a little more sense. But yeah, unfortunately, her entire story's tragic. And the year and a half reporting or delay in reporting for her as a missing person really caused a lot of why her case is still a cold case today. Like I said earlier, Courtney was from Spokane, Washington, and I couldn't find any information that she was enrolled in that tribe, but I'm going to make the assumption that she was a part of the Spokane tribe of Indians. So like Shiashi did in an earlier episode, I want to shed some light on this tribe as this also may be one that people are unfamiliar with. The Spokane tribe of Indians are of the interior Salish speaking tribes who have inhabited the northeast portion of Washington state. There are many different smaller tribes in this region who are also Salish speaking. For instance, two of my really great friends moved here from Washington and they're members of the Colville tribe who are also Salish speaking. So I don't know a lot about the Spokane tribal culture, but, you know, after some research, some things that I found interesting were the word Spokane means children of the sun, and the city of Spokane, Washington, actually acknowledges in their history that their first inhabitants were Native Americans, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, awesome.
Oh, wow.
What did you say earlier? You said what speaking tribe?
Salish.
Salish. I've never heard of that. You know, to be honest, I'm not familiar with too many tribes out in Washington. I didn't realize there were so many.
So from what I understand and from what I've read, a lot of the tribes in Washington are really small, and the majority of them are from the interior Salish-speaking group, or their language all has the same origination, but I think that all the cultures of the tribes are much different. So I couldn't find a whole lot of information on Courtney's childhood, and this is probably because she was placed into the foster care system at a very early age. Soon after she was placed into foster care, Courtney was placed into the home of Judy Holden, which unfortunately is where her tragic story begins. From what I've read, Judy and her husband were known for taking in foster children. According to a story written on storiesoftheunsolved.com, it was reported that Judy Holden had a history of fostering children, mostly as a way to make money, but eventually it was thought that she turned towards abusing most of those children placed into her care.
Now, was she Indigenous woman as well, or?
You know, I couldn't find anything on that, and, you know, I thought about that too, because ICWA was the Indian Child Welfare Act put in place to place Native American children in Native American homes. I have to think that they have some ties, maybe, to some Native culture, but it really wasn't clear.
So just a real quick question. How does fostering kids a way to make money?
So when you foster a child, from what I understand, you're given a stipend to take care of them for their basic needs, maybe for groceries. Typically, you are put on Medicaid, or that child is put on Medicaid. So there's a lot of governmental assistance. You probably get food stamps. So being a foster parent does come with a monetary stipend of sorts. But this lady definitely did not have good intentions, it seems. Her intentions were about getting as many kids as she could through her house just for the money. So shortly after being placed in the Holden household, Courtney was ultimately adopted by them. That's how her last name is Holden. And I also couldn't find any information on her birth name, which I was curious about to see if it was kind of an indigenous name. But everything that I've read, she just went by Courtney Holden.
I find that interesting because you'd think in this day and age, we'd be able to find more information.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. And it was kind of sad to me that I couldn't find anything from her birth name other than her first name. It really seems that she didn't have any family ties. In an article later on, I found some information that she may have had a relationship with her brother, her real brother, but it wasn't really clear. So at the time of her disappearance, Courtney was living with Judy Holden and her adult son, Joshua Holden. According to reports, Judy and her husband had divorced in 2014, which is when Joshua decided to move back home.
They didn't live on a reserve or a town.
I don't think that they did. Again, it's really not clear. And I didn't see that there was tribal law enforcement involved, but it's really confusing. I don't know how much of Spokane is actually reservation and how much is just, you know, part of the city. So I really don't know. And again, that kind of goes back to not knowing a lot about her childhood and her history. So Joshua was known to be aggressive and violent, and some even described him as someone who was very erratic.
Is this from like when he was a kid? Is there like known instances of him being violent as a kid? Is this something that like neighbors have noticed or what?
So it's not clear, and it actually doesn't specifically state that this is her biological son. So I don't know for a fact that he's not an adoptive son. But here's where it gets really strange. So not only did he have a reputation for being aggressive and erratic, he had a pretty lengthy arrest record, which included unlawful imprisonment, which that's going to come up a little bit later, a history of domestic violence, a conviction for burglary, and had twice been accused of rape, once in 2003 and again in 2005. But I can't find that he was ever convicted of rape. But what's so strange to me is that, you know, I would hope at this time she's not still a foster parent, but it's really concerning to me that someone with this record could be around foster children.
Yeah, you would think they would like investigate and know who's in the house and do background checks and things like that. But, you know, what's scary is I think the foster system is so overrun that they're just probably trying to get these kids in homes as much as they can. It's no excuse, but that's really, it's really sad because you don't know who's in these houses with these kids.
You know, the things that go on behind closed doors are never talked about in public. And, you know, it could be shameful if she was a victim of anything related to his past behavior.
Well, that, and I also have this thought that as a foster child or an adoptive child, they may be scared to say something because they don't know where they're going to end up. You know, like, yeah, this house is bad, but what if I end up with no house? You know, and that could be some of the thoughts going through their head, too.
We think about our own kids and the people in our lives and the stability that we provide and the people that we know that they provide to their children and their families. And so when you grow up in a stable household, that's what you know, and that's your comfort, that's your home. When you grow up in chaos and you don't have a home, you don't have a bedroom to call your own, you know, mentally that can affect your judgment. You know, growing up, we can look back on our childhood and think about our childhood bedrooms and, you know, live, you know, as kids. If you don't have that, you want to grasp onto that. You want that. So she may have been scared to report it if there was anything going on.
Well, I think it goes both ways, because if you grow up, you've been abused as a child and that's all you know, then that's all you know. You don't know any different. So those abusive behaviors could be what you think is how a family's supposed to be. So I think it goes both ways. If that's all you know, then...
Do we know how old she was when she entered this household?
No, I don't. It didn't even give me a year that she was placed with them. This household is obviously pretty toxic, and we haven't even really heard about everything that she was subjected to. That's just knowing who the people in the household were.
This sounds like one of these cases where it had to be reported or somebody had to find out in some capacity. Otherwise, this sounds like a girl with no past could really just vanish
And nobody would know it. Like you said, it's been a year and a half before she was reported missing, so nobody did know it. But how did you find out about this?
So unfortunately, Courtney's story is literally the perfect storm. You know, we'll learn more about the dynamics of this family, and I'll get into a little bit more about what she actually dealt with. But you're right, Shiashi. She basically is someone that had no one and disappeared, and no one was looking for her. So clearly, Courtney was living in a really toxic household. Again, I don't know how long she lived in this household, but at her time of disappearance, she was 26 years old. So the more I learned about this case, literally the worse it gets. You know, I'm not sure where this information came from, and honestly, it's pretty concerning to me that people reported this or said this and did nothing about it. But there were multiple reports of Judy and Joshua referring to Courtney as Cindy, not because this was a loving nickname they gave her, but this was actually short for Cinderella. And this was because Courtney was rarely allowed to leave the house in the daylight. If she went outside of the home, she wasn't allowed to go anywhere past the yard, and it had to be at night. She was forced to do all of the household chores. She was basically a servant. She was not allowed to have a cell phone, a car, and she was not allowed to create social media profiles. So she really was basically cut off from the world and forced to be like a live-in servant.
At 26.
You know, if this is happening at 26, it didn't start at 26. This had to start really young for her.
Right. So she's had to live her young adulthood in captivity, it sounds like, shut off from the world.
I'll mention this again because there are some more concerning things, but keep in mind that Joshua had a previous arrest record for unlawful imprisonment.
I was almost going to bring that up because you did say it would come back regarding that. How much older was he than her?
Judy was 74 and Joshua was 40.
He's in his 40s. Most of these arrests could happen while she was in their care. All these reports of things that she can and can't do, is this from like neighbors that are kind of telling what they've noticed? Like, how do we know the extent of that she was denied certain things?
Okay, so there were reports from the neighbors, but, you know, being a millennial, I'm sure that she found some ways to communicate with people because there were reports of her having communication with a girl named Courtney Clay. So there's actually a whole interview done by KXLY, Spokane News Station, that she did an interview and basically was saying she would drop by and check on Courtney. After Courtney's disappearance, she would drop by. Courtney did have friendships and she did have a little bit of communication with people, but it definitely wasn't regular. So I imagine that if people went months without talking to Courtney, it wasn't unfounded, that was probably something that happened a lot. I just have this mental image that if someone dropped by, that Courtney was probably punished for that. And I don't know that for a fact, but, you know, that's probably also why she didn't have a lot of contact with people from outside the home, because I imagine that if she tried to make that contact, it probably didn't go well for her, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that she was allowed to like have outside friendships as much as she was being confined to the house.
Yeah, that's sad.
That's just an assumption. I don't know that for a fact, but that just by listening to the dynamics of this household, I just can't imagine that they would condone her having any sort of friendships or any sort of outlet.
Or anything that would make her happy. They would try to take happiness away, especially from the environment. It sounds like they're miserable. They want her to be even more miserable.
They were controlling, very controlling.
Yeah. So again, this really bothers me because after Courtney's disappearance, neighbors were interviewed by police and reporters, and I'm sure other people, but it was reported that Courtney confided in the neighbors numerous times that she was afraid of Josh. And on multiple occasions, the neighbors noticed bruises on Courtney. In addition to that, Joshua had apparently placed lots of cameras outside of their home. Now, I've seen pictures of this house, and I'm going to be a little judgmental here, but this was not a very nice house. It was a small house. It looked maybe a two-bedroom house. The outside was not well taken care of. There was like junk piled up on the porch. It almost kind of looks like a hoarder's home. I'm going to say that the cameras that he put up all around the house were not to protect their prized possessions. To me, that was to make sure that Courtney didn't escape. What's there to protect?
Well, that, and then the way that you described him, controlling and abusive.
I just looked up the house. I feel like this would be screaming red flags, you know, having all these cameras on this house. It just feels incredulous to me that there are all these things and all the stuff that people notice. And it just feels like this just has gone on for years and nobody's saying anything or...
You know, it does bother. It really bothers me that it seems like every time, you know, more information that I read and more information that comes out came from people that probably knew something was happening, but didn't do anything about it or didn't say anything. It's really frustrating to me. But also, you know, in today's age, like I don't know what I would do. Maybe I would just think, oh, they're weird. I don't know. I guess, you know, when you're put in that situation, you don't know what you would do.
I know what you would do. You'd call the cops.
Well, I call the cops a lot, I will say.
I We're going to put that on a shirt for you.
I'm a cop caller. I really am.
It'll just say, I'll call the cops, Maggie.
Dispatch is saved in my phone as a contact. I don't call 911. I call the non-emergency line.
Put that on a t-shirt. I call the cops.
That's not a bad idea. Because if I'm running and the back of my shirt says, I call the cops, they're not going to mess with me.
That's a great idea. Hold on. I need to.
Hold on. We got a merch idea.
I'll call.
So if you like the episode, go check out our merch. Get a shirt that says, I call the cops.
If you see me and Osh running through town with that shirt on, just leave us alone.
And if you see me brisk walking, just leave me alone. But no, but I'm saying, like, there's all these red flags. There's this house. It's got all these cameras on there. People are saying she can only go outside. She's all this limited contact. I feel like...
Well, it's disturbing to me that people knew she wasn't allowed during the daylight. Like, why is that not concerning? Like, if my neighbors knew that I only let my kids out at night to sit on the porch, like, I would hope to God they would be like, well, that's weird. But then again, I don't know. It's just so weird to me. They may also think this family is just strange because in one of the news articles, there's a picture of the front porch of the house and there's like multiple signs through the yard that are the signs that say, smile, you're on camera. So they really, I mean, maybe they just think they're really weird. And honestly, I think it's creepy that he even has signs out like that. So, you know, I don't know what I would do.
That's a fair point because people have their own weird quirks and things like that. It doesn't always make them terrible people. So I guess it's easy from like, I guess the perspective now that we're at to be like, this is just screaming red flags. But I guess if you're just like a casual passerby or, you know, you don't really pay attention to your neighbors, you just live your own life. Then
I also think too, like personally, like when I think about cases like this, like there is also a risk, like if there's a domestic violence issue that calling the police could actually escalate that. So, you know, that I think about those things too. And, you know, maybe other people consider that because, you know, if it's a true domestic violence situation where the woman or the person is in danger, if you call the cops to that home, like that could be deadly for that person. Depending on what the situation is.
Especially considering her age. She's not a child. Even if she grew up in this house from a young age or as a teenager, from 18 to 26, that's a big range that she could have left. But again, we don't know the circumstances of why she didn't leave. And we can't judge why she didn't leave. But as an adult, living in that type of captivity is very alarming. I mean, it's... She didn't have a job. She didn't... You said she had friends, but...
You know, I don't even really know. I mean, I think these people cared about her, but I don't even know that she would have had enough communication to even be considered friends. They're probably just acquaintances because she probably wasn't allowed to talk to them. And something, you know, speaking of the neighbors and like what you would do in this situation, I think I would definitely do something because the last time anyone from outside the Holden house can recall seeing Courtney alive was in the summer of 2018. When the police officers were doing interviews, a neighbor informed the police that they recalled seeing Courtney leave the house with a packed black duffel bag. As Courtney was trying to leave the house, Judy ran outside and yelled at her to come back in, and it was reported that Courtney responded, "I'm not staying here anymore." Ultimately, they had, you know, a back and forth, and this interaction ended by Joshua physically picking up Courtney and carrying her back into the home.
Okay, if there's ever a reason to call the cops, that would be the one. And a neighbor saw this and didn't call the cops? Is that what you're telling me?
Correct.
Okay, so now I will pass judgment on the neighbor because that's not normal in any circumstance. And
so mind you, when, you know, in 2018, this is a 26-year-old woman who is probably, you know, what's the average 150 pounds, maybe. You're not going to easily pick up a 150 pound woman who doesn't want to go back inside. Like, this had to be a battle. Like, it had to be, you know, she's not willingly going.
Right. It had to be a struggle. It had to have been a scene, you know.
And like Asha said, she's 26 years old. She could legally come and go. She's an adult. But this is where I was going to bring up again. In Joshua's arrest report, he had already been arrested once for unlawful imprisonment. So this just seems like his MO. I mean, this is unlawful imprisonment. She's trying to leave as an adult and she's being forcibly taken back into the home.
And we just talked about whether, you know, when to call and, you know, when to have concern. That's a call. And that's very shameful that people witnessed this and didn't do anything about it. You know, not saying that they're directly responsible for what may have happened to her, because like you said, it's open and we don't know. But, you know, calling the cops at that moment could have prevented maybe other things happening.
There are so many little things that I didn't include everything that was gathered by the neighbors, but there are so many little things. Like it said in a report that a few days after this interaction where Courtney was forcibly taken into the home, that Joshua was acting really erratic and in the middle of the night got up and set up spotlights in his backyard and went and built a playground in the middle of his backyard. So, you know, it seems to me like there's all kinds of red flags. So it's just so weird to me that all of this kept happening like right next door to people and nothing was ever reported to the police.
You said a playground?
Or a play set.
Like a little swing set?
I guess. I mean, if he spent 2 days doing it, it probably was a pretty big project. But why do it in the middle of the night?
And why a swing set if there's no, like, kids? Is there? There wasn't any other kids that were around, were there?
Okay, so Courtney's story, again, she didn't have communication with a lot of people, so a lot of her information is kind of unknown. But Courtney actually was a mom.
What?
So Courtney had a child, but I could not find information on how old her child was.
What?
So in the midst of all this, she had a kid. So hold on. We don't know how old the kid is.
So Courtney did have a kid. And again, I don't know what age she was in foster care. And I don't know how old her kid was. But the kid's father is not anyone in the home.
Okay.
Because that's what I thought. I thought maybe, you know, something happened and it was Joshua's. But this child has a different father who is outside of the home.
So she did have a little bit of communication with someone, a partner.
Yeah, and you know, I kept thinking maybe this was in high school because they're legally obligated to send foster children or adoptive children to school. So I imagined maybe when she was in school, she met someone and maybe got pregnant. But again, I don't know. I know in 2018, the reports were saying her child was young. So the child couldn't have been very old. I just want to remind you guys, the last time Courtney was seen by the neighbors in this interaction where Joshua was carrying her over his shoulder was in 2018. Courtney was not formally reported missing until October 8th, 2019, almost a year and a half later, which still just bothers me. But it tells you kind of what her home life was like. But the child did live in the Holden house as well. So it was reported that visitors who came to the Holden home noted Courtney's young son was made to call Judy mom and Joshua dad. And Courtney's son called her Courtney. He was not allowed to call her mom.
Okay, first of all, ew, because that's a mother and son.
It is deeply disturbing to me.
Yes.
I wonder if he called her Courtney or Cindy, since they called her Cindy.
Ooh.
I don't know. And honestly, it makes me wonder, like, if they brainwashed this kid to think that wasn't even his mom. I don't know. But to me, that is just so disturbing. And there were also reports that they renamed him and called him Forrest, which was not his legal name. So they have, like, completely brainwashed this kid to be a completely different person.
It's a mother and son, and they're like, call me mom and call me dad. This story's just getting grosser as you're telling it.
I know. I told you this whole story, like, the more you learn about it, the more tragic and disturbing it is.
And honestly, from what you're saying, I'm surprised that they actually had visitors to the house.
Well, you know, and I don't, it's really not clear who these visitors were. I don't know if maybe the neighbors were suspicious or maybe it's just this one friend that Courtney would have come drop by. It's really not clear who visitors are, but it seems like people do know kind of the ins and outs of this family a little bit. And I also kind of thought maybe it would be other foster kids who were telling their side of the story. Like maybe they were placed into this home too and are just telling things that they witnessed. I really don't know. I guess they did have visitors, though, because it was reported that when people would ask about Courtney or where she was or what she was doing, because they hadn't seen her in a while, the Holdens would give out many different stories. So sometimes they would say, oh, she's out traveling with her trucker boyfriend, or that he had finally asked her to marry him. So they had run off and got married. Or they would just tell people that she was in the house, but she didn't want to talk to or see anyone. Apparently, after about a year and a half of this, finally someone found this really suspicious.
Oh, just after a year and a half, now things are kind of sketchy. Okay.
We have to remember Courtney is adopted, so she probably doesn't have family ties. She isn't allowed a cell phone, isn't allowed social media. So, you know, it wouldn't be entirely off base for her to not have contact with someone for months or years. She had full custody of her son, so there were no visitation requirements for the child. I understand that her son's biological dad had some substance abuse issues that he was dealing with, so I think he was working towards recovery, but they probably didn't have like a set like call schedule or visitation schedule. So really, there's nothing tying her to the outside world.
You know, I'm kind of surprised at this point that she was able to actually have a man in her life. I feel like they'd had such a tight leash on her that
it probably had to have happened in school, because I can't imagine them even letting her sneak out. Or maybe she did sneak out, and maybe that's when Joshua started putting the cameras in. But Joshua also didn't move in until 2014. It could have very well happened before he moved in, and you know, maybe the household was a little less toxic before he got there.
True.
And in 2014, she would have been an adult, too. She would have been,
22.
So she would have been 22 when Joshua moved in.
It feels like everything that you're telling, like everything's just kind of working against her at this point.
And I know. And that's why I started the story off that I feel like her life was tragic and her story's tragic. And I hate that this is still a cold case, because that means there's a tragic ending, because there's no ending. Like I said, the more I learn about the story, like, it just made me so sad to read, because I feel so terrible that she had to go through this. So ultimately, in the fall of 2019, Courtney was reported missing by the girlfriend of her son's father. When the girlfriend called police, she asked for a welfare check because she had not seen or heard from Courtney in almost 2 years.
And, you know, usually people just go on with their lives.
And I think what happened, and I don't know this for a fact, I'm making assumptions. When I read that Courtney's son's father was working towards sobriety and recovery, I think at this time he was starting to achieve that. So he was probably looking for avenues to reach out to the child and was probably coming up at dead ends.
So I think your theory really makes sense.
A 2 year lead time between, or a year and a half lead time between someone going missing and being reported missing is detrimental. We're true crime followers. We know that the longer someone is missing, the likelihood of them being alive is just less and less.
Isn't it like the first 48 hours are the most crucial when someone's missing?
You know, in regards to any crime, you want information as soon as you possibly can, right? You know, if it goes a year and a half, the likelihood of anything being recovered or resolved is really low.
Do we know if the boyfriend, or, well, I'm sorry, the baby, the her son's father, was he Native American? Was he?
I don't know. And again, this is just, her story isn't told that well. So there's not a lot of facts out there.
Because I think about, you know, living in our small town, kind of know others, you know people in the town, you know of them. You may not see them often, but within a year, they still pop up, you know, whether you cross paths or whether you hear about them, hear, you know, just something. But I just find it odd that for a year and a half, she was missing and nobody missed her. Nobody. And then she has a young son. Obviously, he must not be in some type of school, a daycare, grade school, whatever school he's in, because...
Well, you know, they could very well be sending him to school. And this kid could not think it's weird that Courtney's missing, because that was not his mom to him.
True.
I don't know what that child was raised to know. You know, if he's calling Judy mom to him, his life may have not changed much if Courtney was gone. And that's really sad to me. It's weird that she wasn't reported missing, but mostly it's heartbreaking that someone can be missing for a year and a half and literally no one knows.
Nobody.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to what you were saying, Maggie, about how, you know, there wasn't really much known about her before she came to this family and she was just kind of locked and kept away. For her to go missing and it take this long, you're right. There's probably not many people that knew enough or knew enough about her or even knew of her existence to warrant reporting her missing sooner. Except for the neighbor that saw her being carried back in the house. I'm mad at that person.
After Courtney is reporting missing, things get really weird. On October 8th, which is the same day, Joshua and Judy withdrew $600 from Courtney's bank account. And on this same day, someone who was impersonating Courtney called the Spokane Crime Line and reported that she was in fact not missing and was safe. However, this was later revealed to be Courtney's adoptive sister.
So there's another girl in the house?
I think there have been multiple kids in this home. And again, that's not clear. It could have been someone who maybe was there for only a few years while Courtney was there. Somehow, Courtney got chosen to be the one that stayed. She was the one that was still in the home at age 26. And I don't know how the others got out.
It's probably because she didn't have much of a background before this, you know?
So after Courtney is reported missing, things just get weirder and weirder. On October 10th, police searched the Holden home, and it was reported that the home was full of clutter. There were things everywhere. However, the bed that was supposed to be in Courtney's room had no sheets or blankets on it, and you could tell no one had been there. Since this was a voluntary search and the police officers did not have a warrant, after Judy became nervous, she forced them to leave the home not long after they entered. So they didn't search very much before she forced them out. So police start to notice really concerning things over the next few weeks. There was security footage of Judy and Josh using food stamps issued to Courtney at a grocery store and had her young son with them while they were shopping. The officer stopped by the home randomly again to check in to see if he could lay eyes on Courtney, and Josh answered the door. And Josh told the police officers that she couldn't come and talk because she was taking care of a sick cat, but she was there.
A sick cat.
And the cops were like, okay.
Okay, cool. Hope your cat feels better. Cool.
Well, again, you know, they were just called to do she's reported missing because they can't locate her. But I guess there's still a possibility that as an adult, she could have just, you know, went off on her own, got married. You know, the stories that they were telling. I don't think they have enough compelling evidence at this point to really pressure them. And again, they don't have a warrant. So they can ask the question, but they can't force themselves in the home.
Well, they can't even be like, okay, can you get her for, you know, we just need to know that she's okay. Isn't that the point of a welfare check? Like,
it is, but you don't have to comply.
But she wasn't the one that, you know, they're just taking him at face value. They're not even like,
I don't know that they have a choice. I think until a search warrant is issued, they don't have a whole lot of weight. I think that they can ask the question, but they can't force themselves in the home. But finally, on October 24th, 2019, a search warrant was issued and police officers searched the Holden property. However, upon searching, they discovered that Joshua and Judy had moved.
Okay. So
that's suspicious. So,
it's a little sus.
Well, considering this was, Osh was 24 minus 8, 12. That's not right. Is that right?
16.
How many days is it?
16.
16? Is that what you said? 18? Okay. So considering this, are you sure it's 18?
Wait, did you say 26 minus 8?
No, 24 minus 8.
24 minus 8, 16, yeah.
I was going to say 16, okay. But she said it too fast.
Well, I thought it was 12, so. So considering this was 8 days, oh my God, it's not 8 days.
That's our next shirt. We can't count, but we'll call the cops.
We don't do math.
We solve crimes. Okay, so considering this was only 16 days since she was reported missing, then yeah, it's definitely suspect. So it was reported that during the search of the home that it resulted in lots of evidence, which included Courtney's ID cards, handwritten blackmail notes, which I'm confused about that. I don't know who wrote the blackmail notes. It was reported that there was like 14 burner phones and Courtney's personal journal. So the property was searched with cadaver dogs at this time, but nothing was found. But we have to remember, at this point, this is over a year and a half since anyone has even laid eyes on Courtney.
Oh my gosh. And 14 burner phones?
It was a crazy amount of phones, and I don't really understand that. And again, I don't understand the blackmail notes. I don't know if the blackmail notes were from Judy and Josh, or if Courtney was trying to write blackmail notes to get out of the home. It's really not clear.
Was there not any kind of anything that you found that says what was like the content of those blackmail notes?
Or no. Even the journal?
No, but I imagine the journal probably had really compelling evidence in it. Because if she left her personal journal, you know, she had to be documenting what happened to her every day. But they did leave a lot of clutter in the home, and they left a lot of their personal items that I guess they didn't need. But what they did make sure to take was all of the security tape VHSs. So there was no security footage found in the home.
Oh my gosh, that just, all right, we're adding on to the susness of this whole thing. Because one, they left in a hurry, it seems like. They got their stuff and left, but left enough time to like get all their evidence, I guess, to make sure that was gone with them.
It seems that way. Finally, on December 19th, 2019, police locate Joshua and Judy living in a family member's home in Plano, Texas. They also found Courtney's son with them. Courtney's son was immediately taken from them and placed into Child Protective Services and was reunited with his father. So it makes me feel really good that the child is safe.
Yeah, that just gave me like goosebumps. I'm like, okay, that's...
I just hope he got out in enough time for his childhood to not be traumatic. You know, I don't know how old he was, and I know that your body remembers trauma, but I just really hope that they didn't get a chance to abuse him, you know, and have him remember those things.
Wondering how old he is too, because he's bound to have heard some things. He's bound to have heard them talking. You know, depending on the age, he may know more than he thinks he does.
Yeah.
After the child is reunited with his father, Judy and Joshua were ultimately arrested for identity theft and custodial interference. So I imagine after Courtney was reported missing, Courtney's child's father had some interaction with the police, and that's how the custodial interference charges got added. Police also searched the home where the Holdens were living in Texas and found no trace of Courtney.
Jeez. They just had like a year and a half head start on, I guess, allegedly doing whatever it is they did.
So after being arrested, Judy was ultimately jailed in Nevada and Joshua was jailed in Oklahoma. By March of 2020, they had acquired a lawyer. And it's not really clear if they paid for this lawyer, if it was a public defender. But regardless, their attorney requested the pair be released from custody and was attempting to fight their extradition back to Washington State. So his argument was that if they were released, they would reveal the truth about Courtney's whereabouts. And he tried to say part of his defense was to find Courtney safe so he could prove their innocence.
Okay, if that was the case, they could have said that long ago when the police were searching for her in the first place.
Exactly. I mean,
And now they're just so concerned when they just went off to Texas with her son. I hope the judge was like, no, bruh, none of that makes any sense.
So ultimately, they stayed in jail, and the lawyer was unsuccessful in getting this specific request. However, this is where the story is really going to piss you off.
Great.
Okay. So mind you, this is 2019. So due to the COVID-19 pandemic, Judy was...
Don't you say it.
Judy was released from custody with the only stipulation...
No!
...being that Courtney's son was proved safe. In the same month that Judy was released, Joshua was also released from federal custody due to health concerns.
God.
So he does still stay in jail, but since he had health concerns and the COVID-19 pandemic was rampant in prisons, he was removed from a federal prison and sent to a local state jail in Texas.
I don't even know how to respond to this.
Insert the eye rolls. I'm so annoyed.
And none of that makes sense. I mean, I get COVID, I get it, but yeah, they're essentially, you're just getting away with
a missing woman, and you're not revealing her whereabouts or what happened to her.
But they don't have any charges in regards to that, because there's no evidence that she was harmed. They could still really believe the story that she ran off and got married and, you know, could be in Mexico. Who knows? That's probably the story they're sticking to. But it gets so much worse. And at the end of the story, we can digest what happened, because it still pisses me off.
You're leading us into it, just letting us know that it's not going to get any better. So thank you for managing expectations here.
Keeping it real.
Right.
In a written report by the news station KHQ6, it was reported that Judy ultimately pled guilty to a second-degree custodial interference domestic violence charge and is no longer in custody. And I assume that her time served was credited and she did not have to serve any additional time. In early 2021, so just this year, Joshua also pled guilty to the same custodial interference DV charge and a criminal mischief charge and was sentenced to 135 days in jail for each count.
That's it?
That's it.
We know the backstory that she was confined to the house. She's missing. Nobody knows where she's at. They up and leave. They know where she's at. They know what happened. And I don't understand why there's not more pressure on them.
Have they maintained since, you know, they've been arrested and stuff that they just don't know where she's at? She just left with some boyfriend and is that just their story and they're sticking to it?
That's their story, is that she left on her own accord and they have no clue where she's at. And, you know, it's really sad because I did see some news interviews that interviewed Courtney's son's father, and he said Courtney was a great mother. She was a loving mother. She would never leave our son. And the worst part to me is that he said, I know she's not missing and I know she's not alive because she would reach out to our child.
And you would think too, with the news coverage, it sounds like as little as there was, if there was a missing person, notice for her, why wouldn't she at least call the authorities and say, I'm safe, but I don't want to be found? That's just sad.
It is sad. And like we talked about earlier, I am really glad that this Gabby Petito case has come to an end. But until Gabby Petito's body was found, there was not a lot of pressure to find what happened to her. There was pressure saying, you know, she's missing and we think it's the boyfriend. But there was so much effort into finding her body because they knew without a body, they could not press charges. So this is the same situation. Without evidence, without a body, without something saying that she was injured, they don't have anything to go off of. They don't have any evidence that something did happen to her because she basically doesn't exist. She's just a missing person.
And at this point, like, they know who they can point fingers to and say, these are the people that probably did it. These are the people that we need to keep our eye on because all these stories are coming about how they treated her. And you're right. You know, with the whole Gabby Petito thing, I mean, it was massive. The media coverage was massive. And it's just heartbreaking that this girl who really just kind of didn't stand a chance from her being little, that she goes missing. And, you know, nobody bats an eye when there was, you know, all this history of how she'd been treated all this time. It's not fair.
It's not. And sadly, you know, kids in the foster system probably get left behind like this all the time. You know, probably not in circumstances as serious as this, but after they're out of the foster system, once they turn 18, there are so many kids that don't get a chance. Once they turn 18, they don't have support. They don't have anyone to turn to. And 18, like, you need that. You're an adult, yes, technically and legally, but you're still a kid.
You need that support and that guidance. I'm just sad that she didn't have that, and that she didn't have stability, and that she didn't have love and comfort in a home. Her story's sad. Her existence in the eyes of her caretakers were not important. And now that she's missing, it's still not important to them because they're not helping solve the case by giving answers or trying to help them locate her if she is still alive. And so it's just sad that her life was lived in a sad situation. I really hope that she is somewhere living and thriving, but it doesn't sound good.
And at this point, why would they try and help find her and be like, yeah, we think she's probably dead? Why would they? It's clear at this point they got like minimal charges. You know, the mother got out of jail and he's only serving like 100+ days for each count. Like, why would they at this point? There's no active search. There's no flyers and people still trying to keep her case alive. And why would they come out and be like, we can help you find her? They don't sound like upstanding people that would be willing to do that. Anyways, But Maggie, I was going to ask, in your research, when all this, you know, came out and everything, has there been any family members at all that have kind of came out the woodwork for her?
So the friend that did the interview that said she did have some communication with Courtney, I understand now that that friend is actually marrying Courtney's brother. So that would have been Courtney's sister-in-law. But I don't think they had really a relationship because of the environment that she was in. She has been speaking out, and so has Courtney's son's dad. So there are people still trying to speak out on her behalf. But, you know, at this point, Courtney's voice is just lost. And that's why I wanted to do this case, because she's like the epitome of what we're trying to highlight, is these Native American cases who are blatantly suspicious, but their voices just go silent. I mean, no one's talking about it. No one's asking where she's at. No one's putting together a search party. No one's questioning these people who we know have something to do with it.
You know, the reason why we're doing this podcast in the first place, and it goes back to the whole, this Gabby Petito really kind of brought it to the forefront, because, you know, nobody's talking about this girl that we're talking about today. You know, in Wyoming, I think we had mentioned last time that there was like 710 missing Indigenous women in that state alone. But one person who doesn't live in that state got massive media coverage everywhere. They, you know, found her body within just a matter of days. I think what's really been hard trying to find stories and look into this is that we have these roadblocks and getting information and finding a lot of background information. You struggled a lot in this story because there wasn't a lot out there about her or her life prior to entering in the foster care system. And I'm really grateful for you guys being willing to kind of jump in this and help share these stories, because you're right, there's stories that need to be told because people just aren't talking about them. Why aren't they talking about them? Why are these Indigenous women not important enough for this massive media coverage? Why are they not the topics of these massive like hunts for, to find out where they are, or, you know, bring their families closure? Where's Dog the Bounty Hunter for these women?
If I go missing, somebody better call Dog the Bounty Hunter. I better be on TV.
We will have massive manhunts. We will make sure that you get on the news. We will have Perez Hilton blogging about you. And t-shirts.
You know, and I feel like this story is so heavy, and I hate to even have like any sort of banter in the midst of everything going on. That is really why the Gabby Petito case took off, is because she was a social media influencer. So she had a following and people knew who she was and people cared about her. And this girl just didn't have that luxury. So I'll end by saying that according to all the reports, it did seem that detectives did spend months interviewing witnesses and following leads and trying to find any clue about Courtney's disappearance. However, with no credible sightings of Courtney and the delay in reporting her missing, they were already at a disadvantage. Courtney Karina Holden was last seen in Spokane, Washington during the summer of 2018. At the time of her disappearance, she was 26 years old, stood between 5'5" and 5'7", and weighed approximately 150 to 170 pounds. She's of Native American heritage, with black hair and brown eyes. Currently, her case is classified as endangered missing. If alive, she would be 29 years old. Those with information regarding the case are asked to contact the Spokane Police Department at 509-755-2489 or Crime Check at 509-456-2233.
Thank you for listening to We Are Resilient. For links for information found in this episode and to stay up to date on what's coming next, you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at We Are Resilient Podcast. Send us an email at weareresilientpod@gmail.com or visit us at www.war-podcast.com.